encourage any further, except to say that when you finish speaking, we will have a glass of wine while we discuss your paper. But now I'm going to ask Lawrence to tell us about speed dating.
Well, thank you very much, Nicholas. I think the title is actually The Lure of Paris and Speed Dating in the Pubs of Letters.
Well, I had to get people in the room.
No. We'll get on to the speed dating as the paper proceeds. Is there anybody in this room who's never been to Paris? Well,
that's after the glass of wine.
I first went to Paris when I was 16, and it was the first time I'd ever been abroad, and I was absolutely bowled over by the place. Having spent 5 years at school having French thrust down me, it was interesting to discover that people actually did speak this language somewhere in Europe. Because in those days, one had no contact really with anywhere outside the UK. They spoke it and they could actually vaguely understand me as well. So I enjoyed myself immensely for the week I was there. And I've, in a way, been going back ever since. I suppose I should just confess at this point that there is a slight family connection in all this, in that my great uncle, who goes under the name of J. Frank Brocklis, sounds very pompous, was one of the pioneers of the cinema in the silent era. And before the war, the firm had offices in London, Strasbourg and Paris. And he did make some silent films in France, including La Reine Elisabeth, which is a quite well-known silent film of French cinema, starring Sarah Bernhardt. But at that time, as far as I know, just had one leg. So I've often wanted to know how they managed to get her to wander around on set. But anyway, I've been sort of brought up with this idea that Paris was an interesting, exotic place. And it was probably inevitable that when I eventually got down to being a researcher myself, that I'd be concentrating on Paris. And I think that probably, therefore, it's only right that for my last appearance on the stage in my guise as an Oxford tutor, I should again speak about Paris, and Paris in the 18th century, which is the period that I've worked on the most. Now, the paper really is built around an assertion, which any of you can challenge if you wish, but I suspect it is difficult to do so. And that assertion is that of all the cities in 18th century Europe north of the Alps, Paris was the most visited in the 18th century. And what I want to do is really talk a bit about the visitors, which is not particularly novel or original, but then try and offer some suggestions as to why that might be. And this will move us on to speed dating in the Republic of Letters. Paris, like most cities, not just big cities in the 18th century, attracted lots and lots of migrants, people who came in for about 6 months or a year and went back home again. But I'm not going to talk about the workers. I mean, if Olwen Houghton was here, I'm sure she could tell you everything you wanted to know about Paris migrants in the 18th century. What I want to talk about are the people who come from relatively well-to-do backgrounds and come to Paris for study or for entertainment and delight. And I'm going to start off with the student body, and that's what the first overhead is referring to, because I think that there were at least 300 to 400 foreigners studying in Paris on the eve of the French Revolution. Some of them are studying in the Faculty of Theology at Paris and in the Faculty of Law. And as you can see from the slide you've got on the screen, something like the 10.8% of the people who get a degree in theology at the Paris faculty on the eve of the revolution come from outside France. It sounds very grand to say foreign. In fact, they're all Irish. Yeah. They come from one particular part of Europe, and that's simply because the University of Paris in the 18th century serves as the university for Irish Catholics. So virtually all of the foreigners be found in any of the faculties of the University of Paris in the 18th century come from Ireland. There's an Irish college at Paris, called the College de Lombard, which used to belong to it was an Italian college that took people from Lombardy until it became the Irish college. And numbers vary, but there's probably at least 200 to 300 people living in that college or living in buildings attached to that college on the eve of the revolution. But there are lots more foreigners in Paris studying than simply those at the University of Paris, because there are lots of other educational institutions, both private and public, which attract people from around the continent. I can't give you exact numbers, but there is one institution that did attract foreigners where there are numbers, and I will then give you those. And that's the College of Surgery. It is not attached to the university at all. It's an independent institution set up in the 1720s. And across that 40-year period from 1750 to 1790, something like 1,000 foreigners pass through it. And obviously, there are only about, 24 there per year in 1785-91. But across the period, there's a steady sort of surge of people coming to Paris to study surgery. And they come from all over Europe, not just, of course, from Ireland or even from Britain. So that's a much more sort of cosmopolitan institution. Now, on top of that, you'll find foreigners studying at the Jardin du Roi, the Botanical Garden, which teaches chemistry and surgery, anatomy as well as botany, and various other places, especially cramming schools that were preparing people for mathematical examinations so they could enter the various branches of the French administration already admitted through exam. So this is one group of the people from around Europe who had to be found in Paris on the eve of the revolution. They're a group I know most about. But there's another group, which I expect most of you know about, were the tourists, who are there for some reason or other in the months leading up to the revolution and before. Now, I think there are, really speaking, about four or five different groups of sort of tourists in Paris in the second half of the 18th century. There are certainly people on business who come from all around Europe. Then there are the health tourists, the interesting group, the health tourists. They're the people who go over to Spa or go to another watering hole in Europe and on their way back home tend to pass through Paris to spend a couple of weeks or months there. Then there are the people, again from all parts of Northern Europe, who are heading south to Italy and the Somme, and they tend to pass through Paris on the way down. There are certainly people there too who are just taking in Paris, not really going anywhere except Paris. They're the ones who are on the run. Paris is clearly a place where quite a few people go to lose themselves for a few months when life gets somewhat hot in the places they come from. And then, of course, there are all the people trying to make money. The Mozarts, Cagliostro, Mesmer. The list of names of people who pass through Paris in the second half of the 18th century, trying to make a quick buck, is legion. Now, often they're doing a bit of everything, sightseeing, making money, even some of them are studying at the same time. Now, how many of these people there are in any one year is impossible to say, but I'm sure that all of you around this room can give me a few names of people you know who spent some time in Paris in the second half of the 18th century. Just to sort of set the ball rolling, to get you thinking, I'll throw out a few kind of Anglo-American names. Boswell's there in 1764. The future Surgeon General of America, Benjamin Rush, is there in 1769. Dr. Johnson, of all people, is there in 1775. Spends 2 months in the place. The great socialite, Francis Anne Crewe, great sort of Whig Madame, is there in 1786, and of course Arthur Young is there in 1790, we'll go on and on and on, give me a list. And some will keep on coming. This chap, you know who he is? He's William Beckford. I thought I'd throw him in because we've had a paper on Beckford fairly recently, so I thought he'd throw him in for an example. He comes in 1777 with his tutor en route to Switzerland to finish his education. Then in 1784, he's back with his wife, Margaret. Not a good and happy relationship, I must say. And among other things he gets up to, he supposedly goes to the Jardin du Roi and enters the cage of the lion in order to pet it. And he's also attending the salon of Madame Necker at the same time. He visits the great neoclassical architect, Ledoux, and then he's back again in 1788 to 93, and he stays there for a few years. Now he's on the run at this point. He's unfortunately been discovered making homosexual advances to the son of the Earl of Devon at Powderham, so he decides to retire to the continent. And while he's in the on the continent, he does very nicely for himself because he sits out the revolution and he spends most of his days buying up art from aristocrats who are in need of a few pennies. And somehow or other, during the terror, he managed to ship it all the way across from Calais to Dover and set up his own very nice art collection. He sells a lot as well. So he was one of the people who was busy buying up French objets d'art and getting them across the channel as soon as the revolution breaks out. Now, I said, we don't know how many people there are, but according to the great Daniel Roche, who has counted the number of people who in any one year are given passports to stay in Paris by the French authorities, there are in 1789 2,602 foreigners in the city, 286 Englishmen, which probably means people from the British Isles generally, in hotels, and another 162 are sort of floating and turn up in police reports. So there's probably at least 400 people from this island in Paris on the eve of the revolution. And if you sort of throw in the students, so there must be sort of 3,000 to 4,000 foreigners floating around in Paris when the Bastille falls. Now, I wouldn't want to argue that other big cities in Europe do not attract lots of people. They clearly do, but I don't think that they ever attract numbers in such quantity. It's very difficult to find other universities or educational institutions that attract foreigners in the way that Paris seems to do in this period. There are plenty of people floating around in London attending the various hospitals. And according to Susan Lawrence, there are about 223 of them who sign up in 1800, but they're all from the British Isles, none of them are from abroad. So what is the attraction of Paris? This may seem a totally ridiculous question to ask, but I think it's useful to inquire why there are so many people in Paris, because I suspect that in the 17th century and the 16th century, this was not the case at all. We're used to a world where everybody goes to Paris, but I think it really begins in the 18th century. So let me suggest a few reasons, and this will gradually get me on to speed dating. First of all, location. It happens to be very handily placed for all those from Northern Europe moving southwards to Italy, as I've already kind of implied. And a lot of them, in fact, a growing number of people are moving south in the 18th century. There are people moving in the other direction. I want to say there's not a grand tour that goes the other way, but there are not many of them. And if they are going that direction, then if they're going anywhere, they frequently don't go to many of the great northern cities. Here's one man who was moving northwards. This chap. He's an Italian. Scipione Maffei. Veronese antiquarian and naturalist. 1736, he moves north to see the northern world. Spends 3 years in Paris. And then he decides he'll go somewhere else. So he spends about 2 months over here. Visits Oxford, by the way, very briefly. And Cambridge. And then he goes back, crosses the North Sea, and goes to Amsterdam and then Vienna on the way home. But he basically comes to Paris. He does have a northern tour, but it's not really a northern tour. It's a visit to the French capital. I'll tell you a bit more about him and his pal at the end of the tour. But he's a classic example. Another classic example of someone who is on the northern tour is someone that our Russianists here will know only too well, the famous Madame Dashkova.
Princess.
Princess, all right. I would call her Dashkova, Madame Dashkova. She's in Paris in 1769. She passes through from Brussels and she's there again in 1780. She's a very interesting character. She's the only person I've ever encountered on the foreign grand tour northwards who goes to Dublin. Dublin is this massive city of 200,000 people, but nobody ever visits the place. I've got a research pupil at the moment who's working on the Republican letters in Dublin in the 18th century, and she very kindly sent me her latest list of people who actually go to Dublin. And it, across the 18th century, it sort of narrows down to about 20 people, all of them except about three from Britain. Dublin is not a place that anybody goes to visit. People move from Dublin into Europe, but they don't go visit. And in the same aspect, Copenhagen or Uppsala or any of these places, that they are not places that people go to visit at all. St. Petersburg, people go to St. Petersburg, but not that many at all. So Paris is very different among northern cities in that it does attract an awful lot of people. Now, that's one point. And second point, more frivolous, is it is both expensive and difficult to stay there. As everyone knows, it's very easy to move to London and stay there for the rest of your life, as Dr. Johnson rather rudely pointed out at one point, God the Scots. Actually, it's quite difficult to move to Paris permanently in the 18th century. This is because it is a city that is very incorporated in its various activities. And you can't move to Paris permanently and set yourself up. Some people try to, but they frequently come to grief if they do. It's very, very expensive indeed to buy yourself into any of the sort of pucker professional guilds. So it's the kind of place that parents didn't mind their children going to for a bit because they knew they'd come back home. Some, of course, went back reluctantly, including the great Robespierre, who spent a long time in Paris as a student, training to be a lawyer, got his law degree, but unfortunately had then go back home to Sleepy Arras, where his dad came from, and joined the Corporation of Lawyers there. Explains the French Revolution, I think. All these people had to go back home after they spent years in Paris. So if you were a nobleman or anybody with money who sent their kids off on the grand tour, you didn't mind them going to Paris at all because you knew they weren't going to stay there for more than 2 or 3 months. And it was also very expensive, so their money ran out pretty quickly, so they didn't have to come home after that. So I think that's a frivolous, but it's an important point. You know, it was a place you passed through or spent time in. You didn't stay there permanently. Then, of course, there's the language. But if people from abroad know any language, maybe if you're not French, they know French. And they're likely to end up in a big French city rather than anywhere else. And I thought I'd demonstrate just how hard going it could be for the poor old Brits when they're in Paris in the 18th century. This is a letter, or a diary, which is a letter from Frances Crewe, who tells us, I won't read it out, that spends a night at the English ambassador's. You see, well, there is great comfort, I think, in being now and then released from the labour of expressing oneself in a foreign language, which, by the way, is often not only fatiguing, but embarrassing likewise. I feel for this poor woman who was forced to speak French while she was in Paris. But the language is another reason for people going to Paris. And then there's the delights, and this is what you think of, things you see, and there are lots of things to see in Paris. Nicholas, remember that we had a talk a couple of years ago by a chap who told us about how Paris was being built before the French Revolution. I mean, it was a building site, so many things going on for you to see. But what most people came to Paris to do was to see the king eat. I don't know about any other princely family in the 18th century allowed the hoi polloi in to have a look at him munching, but Louis XVI clearly did, and they all did it. Dashkova went to see it, even Johnson went to see Louis XV, but it was a kind of No, 16, eating, a bit of Fontainebleau, rather Versailles. And I thought I would just sort of put up on the board Johnson's view of the French, just to sort of show that he really was a Brexiteer avant la lettre. That's his description of attending the king fed himself with his left hand as we. So Louis XVI was left handed. Anyway, this is what he says to Boswell. But the great in France live very magnificently, but the rest miserably. There is no happy middle state in England. The shops of Paris mean. The mean of the markets is such as to be sent to a jail in England. And Mr. Thrale justly observed the cookery of the French was for, can't read that, was for something rather, upon them by necessity, for they could not eat their meat unless they added some taste to it. The French are an indelicate people. They will spit upon, actually I better look at my own text here. Anyway, it ends up saying, nature has done more for the French, but they have less for themselves than the Scotch have done. So that was his view when he got back, that he didn't inform much of the French, but he actually did go, and he did look at the king eating. There's a, do you know the Kirsten Dunst film, the Marie Antoinette, where they eat, they all come in to have a look. So everybody went to see the king. That was the great sight that they all went to. And if you kind of wanted to get off the tourist road, there were lots of other things to do. And I thought I'd put, this is Beckford, who knew how to get around in life. This is his view of Paris. More festive, more glittering, more abominably depraved than ever was, known to be since the pious era of Henry III, his chaste mother, Catherine de Medici. The perpetual noise and bustles of theatre, ballrooms and gaming houses passes all idea. The capital perhaps has never before so thickly or effervescently peopled, its traps continually set, has continued to catch victims, its innumerable dens of corruption, without lacerating in some shape or other very quick. Anyway, you get the picture. I mean, Paris, even in the 18th century, had this, it was a place that people kind of went to enjoy themselves in ways they couldn't do even in London, which was actually a puritanical city in many ways, and you could have got away with the things going on there. But so a lot of people do go there because it's got a lot to do. I suppose I should mention the Salon, but you know the Salon had been overhyped, and thanks to Lyulty, we now know that they're really nothing more than places where the would-be writers got together with aristos to be patronised without really being patronised. But nonetheless, I think the thing one should say about the Salon, and this comes out in Benjamin Rush's manuscript memoir, is that foreigners could get into them. Whereas in London, where there were lots of Salon in London and lots of other places as well, foreigners just weren't allowed in. Even American, I mean, Rush comes down to London, he's not really allowed to mix with these very select groups. In Paris, on the other hand, although he's kind of anonymous American, he seems to attend a wide variety of salons. Now we know that there are big differences between coming in for tea and coming in for dinner, but they do seem to be relatively open, and that again is, I think, great attraction. You could actually at least go and stare at the great and good, if nothing else. Anyway, the point that moves me on to speed dating is the intellectual side of all this, because what, from my point of view, interests me about Paris is the sheer number of members, paid up members, active members of the Republic of Letters that one could find in Paris. And I do think that if you add up all the people in the various academies, and remember that it isn't just an Academy of Sciences, there's one of inscriptions, there's one of surgery, by the end of the Ancien Régime, there's one for medicine, plus all the, if you think of all the collections or the libraries and the museums that exist, all the different private collections there, and they're all kind of listed in the guidebooks, then there's nowhere else like it in Northern Europe that you could possibly go and visit. And this is actually very important if you are a parvenu in the Republic of Letters and you want to get on. There are different ways of getting on in the Republic of Letters, but the most obvious way is actually to meet other people. Before we get on there, let me talk about another way, because this is just such a good quotation. In some people, if they wanted to get to know big fish when they started out, would just write them a letter. And one man who does this in 1731 is this guy. And that's not Linnaeus. This man, Boissier de Sauvage. Most of you probably haven't heard of Boissier de Sauvage, but he is the father of nosology, supposedly. Professor at Montpellier. And he's born in 1706, so in 1731 he is a very young man indeed. And he's just published the first go at producing a nosology. So now what does he do? He immediately sends a copy to the great Boerhaave, who's the leading professor of medicine in the early 18th century in Europe. He's based at Leiden. And he sends him a copy of this book, which is kind of invitation to enter into a correspondence. And it looks as if Boerhaave replies positively, because we know from Boisset de Sauvage's letters to his pal in Nîmes, man called Pierre Bull, that he's getting letters from Boerhaave. Now, a few years later, in 1737, another would-be member of the public letters, let's go back one, Linnaeus, who has had to come away from Sweden to get to know people, is based in Amsterdam. He writes to Boisset de Sauvage, asking if, essentially, they can begin a correspondence. And he writes the most sucking letter I have ever come across in my life. Now, I'm sorry, it's in Latin, but the only bit you really need to know is the bit when he says he's been looking for the nosology that Boissier de Sauvage has written, and he knows about this. But he says, I've looked everywhere. You know, Sweden, Lapland, Norway, Denmark, Germany, Belgium, England. The only thing I know is the title. Nobody's got this book. And then he's recently been in Leiden, and he's seen a copy. You know, I have seen it. I've inspected it. And he says, I have been overwhelmed by it. I have felt my inmost inner breast struck as a result by some anxiety, having some read this thing. And it goes on and on. So at the end, it says, right at the bottom, I am unable, therefore, to lack your book. Every day is a torture that I don't have a copy. So what he wants is a copy of this book. And he says, you know, if you send it to me, you know, I'll pay for the postage. And there's a wonderful line that says, you know, I will never die being ungrateful for your favour. And it's, you know, oh, that your method, or I can't wait until your method to be used in botany, which is rather amusing given what Linnaeus is to go on and do, and on insects. Anyway, perhaps you'd like in return my own books, including my Lapland Flora and his first edition of his plant genera. I've just never come across a letter in the Republic of Letters of someone who says he's sort of basically struck dumb when he looks at a book. That his heart's going, that's just wonderful. But anyway, it does seem to work. And thereafter, Boissier and Linnaeus do enter into a correspondence. But generally, the point is, this doesn't work. Linnaeus very quickly becomes very famous, and we have, essentially, online, a complete Linnaean correspondence these days. So we know everybody who writes into him, and everybody who writes out, and everybody who writes to him. And basically, he doesn't answer anybody's letters at all. He's far too important by the 1740s to correspond with anybody. Anybody would include the Oxford professor of botany, poor old Sibthorpe, who does write to him in the 1740s and never gets a reply at all. So just writing letters, unless I suppose you can come up with something that's unbeatable like that, you're going to get nowhere. You need to meet people. And the only way you can meet people is you go on the road. And in the second half of the 18th century, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of tyro republican of letters tripping up and down Europe trying to meet people. And this is where speed dating comes in. Because the one thing you learn pretty quickly is that even if you've got a letter of introduction, even if you are looking to be face to face with one of the great and good, the chances are that they will not let you in. And this is not really because they are particularly uncivil, but because they are overwhelmed by the number of people who come knocking at the door. And we all know about Voltaire and the way he was always sick when everybody came to see him. Well, sickness is the obvious way of dealing with this. Politeness demands that if someone turns up with a letter, you see them. So you have to develop some kind of strategy for dealing with the importunate. And being ill is the most obvious one. So when one reads continually that the people in public letters are ill and people write books about sickness in public letters, no one really seems to pick up the fact that this is a strategy rather than anything else. They are sick by design. But if that's the case, if you know that most of the people whose doors you knock on are not going to answer, you've got to maximise the number of hits, really. And the way you do that is by going to a place where there are the largest number of people whose doors you could knock on. You do not go to Fairly to sort of knock on one door. You go to Paris where there are hundreds knock on. And it usually works. So let me now talk about the person whose autobiography I'm in the middle of publishing, or you are in the middle of publishing, Pierre-Joseph Amorin. Amorin got his degree at Montpellier in the early 1760s. He's already becoming somebody in Montpellier, he's a member of the local academy, and he's already trying to branch out. Inevitably, he writes Linnaeus and doesn't get a reply. Try sending Linnaeus the copy of his bachelor's thesis. Not a very good move, I suspect. So he's decided not to go down that route anymore. He's going to go up to Paris. He stays his father to pay him to go. So up he goes. I won't go through all the things that I can take from his autobiography, but you can see from rapidly looking at this that he does pretty well. Arrive à Paris, j'employe les premiers jours à faire des visites. And I can see a mistake already, that's not good. Anyway, he meets, well, he's got letters of introduction to a wide variety of people. He meets the astronomer de la Lande, he meets the great experimental physicist Abbé Nolle, and above all, he turns up with a letter from one of his pals, Gouin in Montpellier, to Bernard Jussieu, the great botanist. And he's in. And from then on, he's meeting Jussieu all the time. He's going up to the Mauritanian around Paris and getting to know the botanical world in Paris. So he's made it. But it's not that easy. And it's quite clear from the autobiography that frequently there are problems. One point, he goes out to Versailles to try to meet Monsieur Senac, who's the king's chief physician. Unfortunately, he's out. It's the other thing. They might not be sick, they might be out. If you actually work on the public letters, the number of times that individuals pass through a town and knock on the door of somebody they know pretty well, and that person's not there, amazes me. And frequently the case, they continually miss each other because they don't have this instantaneous communication that we have. So you just knock on, just anyway, poor old Amorin goes to Versailles, Senac is out, and he has to put up with his wife. And clearly, his wife is not too happy with having to meet these people the whole time. And she says, well, she's pretty disrespectful about Montpellier, and her son has actually gone down there for a degree. So anyway, you can get the message. They insult one another, or he claims they insult one another. So it's not easy even for him. And sometimes he has to be very crafty. And this is what happens on another case. And again, I won't read through it. D'Argenville is the expert of the classification of shells. He's old, the firm, supposedly. And he apparently no longer receives amateur chez lui. Anyway, of course, he turns up and he's immediately told that he's too sick to see him. So he has to change tack, and this is to say that he belongs to the Academy of Sciences in Montpellier, that D'Argenville has written about Amorin's own father's collection, so he is an acceptable member of the Republic Letters, and then apparently that then opens doors. I suspect it was much more complicated than that, but you get the sense of the way you have to negotiate your way in. My favourite example of all this is nothing to do with Amorin, but to do with a Genevan botanist called Candolle, who is in Paris in the 1790s. And he needs to meet Lamarck. He wants to enter the world of botany and zoology, and he's desperate to meet Lamarck. But he hasn't got a letter, he's got no introductions at all. So this is for all of you graduate students who want to know how to get on in the world. That's Kendall. That's Lamarck, and this is how he meets him. He stalks him, essentially, and finds out where he eats. So he finds out where he goes to eat. And he and a pal called Pite grab the table next to him and begin talking about Lamarck's French flora that came out just before the revolution. And presumably they just go on and on talking about this book until Lamarck can't stand it anymore and turns and begins having a conversation with them. And it works. I mean, then, from then onwards, he knows Lamarck. Now, I don't know how long it would have taken him to position himself like this, but you really do have to do some quite some fancy footwork to get yourself introduced in, even in somewhere like Paris. So, point I'm trying to make is that Paris is the place. There are so many of these people that as you rush around the 2 months you're there, desperately trying to make contact with people, you'll like to find some people who take you in, however many times you're rejected. So working on the principle that you maximise your chances, then of all places you could go to meet people in the Republic of Letters, I would think that in north of the Alps, certainly, Paris is the place you go to. Now, I don't want to go on too long, and I want to sort of wind this up in a 5 minutes or so, but I want to turn the whole thing at this point and say that there are exceptions to this rule, that there are some relatively small towns where people do go in great numbers. Not very small towns. No one comes to Oxford in the 18th century. Actually, Linnaeus does come to Oxford, but you don't generally come to Oxford if you could possibly help it, if you come on the northern tour. Maffei, the chap I mentioned before, he comes to Oxford, and he comes with a man I'm about to mention in a moment, Séguier from Nîmes. And they spend about 2 or 3 days here, and there's only one person in the whole of the university who's a fellow at Queen's that they actually meet and have a conversation with. The rest of the time they go around looking at buildings and sort of look at the Bodleian, but there's clearly nobody in Oxford in the 18th century, in the 1730s, that any respectable Republic of Letters actually want to get to know. This doesn't mean that there's nobody in Oxford at some time in their lives who is of significance in the European Republic of Letters, but they're never here. I mean, talk about Danton, they're never being here, but they're never here in Oxford either. They're usually in London or somewhere else. Perhaps on the grand tour themselves, like the Maudlin fellow, Richard Chandler, who goes off to the Ottoman Empire and goes out collecting inscriptions in the 1760s. And as soon as he gets married, he's actually the man who gets married, puts down his fellowship, and takes his wife on the honeymoon to Italy to collect inscriptions. And in so doing, gets to know an awful lot of people who then copy inscriptions for him that are sent back to England. His great desire was to create the ultimate edition of Pindar. And he had people scouring all the libraries in Italy for manuscripts of Pindar. He never finishes his work, by the way. Anyway. There are, on the other hand, a few places where people do turn up, because there is somebody there who isn't Voltaire and isn't sick and actually is willing to talk with just about anybody who arrives. And this is my hero, the one Republican of Letters in the whole of my long career that I would actually have liked to have met, because he seems to have time for everybody. And this is this man, Jean-François Séguier, about whom we know much more now because his correspondence is gradually being put up on the web thanks to a group of people down in Nîmes. He's literally picked up by Maffei in the 1730s. Maffei passes through Nîmes on the way north and meets this young man who's in his 20s and says, "Be my secretary." And he says yes. His family allow him to do this. He spends the next 20, 25 years with Maffei. He goes up to Paris with him. His correspondence from Paris is hilariously funny about Voltaire. of the things that he's learned. He then goes over to England with him and comes back to the Verona and acts as his secretary in Verona until Maffei dies in the late 1750s. He then comes back to Nîmes. By that time, he's quite famous. He's number one of Linnaeus' correspondents. He's an important botanist, bibliographer, perhaps more than anything else. And he comes back and sets up his own collections and his library in his house that he buys. And from then onwards, for the next 20 years, he's just somebody who you can go and visit in Nîmes on the way south. And people visit him in droves. Between 1773 and 1783, 1,402 people visit Sévier. It's like 11 years. And you can work it out for yourself. There are not many days in the year when somebody doesn't knock on Sévier's door and have a chat with him. And it's not just a chat, because he takes them around the ruins in Nîmes as well. So he must spend several hours with them. And they come from all parts of Europe. You'll be pleased to see that. How many Russians are there? There's 23 Russians call upon him. Now, I presume everybody has to speak in Russian. They might speak Latin, I don't know. He knows a bit of English, so it must have been interesting. They speak French. They speak French, yeah, but I presume they might speak French with him. And there's some quite interesting people land up on his doorstep, including Joseph II, who's wandering around Europe as Count Falkenstein at this point. But he seems to me to be the ideal republican of letters. He never seems to turn, but he's never ill, as far as I can see. Yeah. And in the summer months, he's usually seeing three or four people, and they're coming with their wives and their children. And he's always polite, always talks to them, and they all sign the visitor's book, and then they go off. So if you get a place like Nîmes, and Nîmes had its own academy, it had 50,000 people, it's not a small town, big town. And of course, it's probably just about majority Protestant as well. So it attracts people from the Protestant parts of Europe. But if you think about it, it's not actually on the direct route south. You go south, you could go to Avignon and pass southwest. You have to sort of go to the right once you're there. You have to make a detour to Nîmes. So the people who go there because of Sévier and the fact he is so willing to talk to them, and offers the chance of them joining his quite extensive network of correspondence. So Nîmes is sort of exception that proves the rule, as far as I'm concerned. Normally, towns that size wouldn't attract people at all. But I thought I'd just introduce you to Sévier, because he's someone that I've worked on and off for many years, and he has become more and more known. His one great claim to fame, he has one, is that he cracked the inscription above the, well, on the pediment of the Maison Carrée. He studied the rivet holes and worked out what the inscription said, published this in about 1761, and that made his name all over Europe, became very famous. Anyway, so that's really all I'm going to say. I said I'd get it done in just over 3 quarters of an hour, and I have done. I just want to try to get you thinking, I suppose, spatially about the Republic of Letters. People are on the move more and more after 1750. We're very aware of this. Where they go is obviously affected by who they are and what they're wanting to do. But if you are a young man in the Republic of Letters, there are some places that are much more likely to be useful to you than others. And I think of all the places that would be useful to you in Northern Europe, it's Paris, simple as that. The sheer number of people that are there that you can make contact with. I don't think there are many people who come away from Paris who haven't made some contact with somebody. It's not in any way without its cost, in that when you go back home, you're expected to find specimens or artifacts for these people in Paris. They're using you, they're manipulating you. The Republic of Letters is like that. But it gives you a sort of a toe in the door, which from then onwards you can exploit to gradually move up the hierarchy or the ladder yourself, if you've got the gumption and the ability and the willingness to do it. And this is what Linnaeus did when he came down from Sweden. He got to know the right people first of all. So Paris, I think, is whatever many will say about the Republic of Letters and Enlightenment being sort of now decentralised. I don't usually stick up for Danton, but I do think that at the end of the day, Paris is at the centre, certainly of one part of the intellectual world in the 18th century. Okay, thank you.